Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hi, welcome to the Football Writers Podcast. My name's Mike Calvin. I'm joined by Dave Kidd of The Sun and Sarah Shepherd from The Coach's Voice. So, football's coming home, sort of. Whatever we think about the Nations League, and it's probably an improvement on friendlies against Estonia, it's been a breakthrough year for England. They've reached the World Cup semi-final, they've won in Spain, and they're in the final four of the Nations League. I suppose the question is, Dave, how far can this group go?
Well, they could certainly win the Nations League because they're playing Switzerland, Portugal, and quite possibly Holland in the final four. So they may even go in as favourites, possibly, I'm sure. Mm. The Portuguese will host.
Whatever that might mean.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we all love it now, don't we? We weren't sure about it at the start. But it has been really quite engaging. I think particularly the group England have been in because it was so tight. It was this ridiculous situation where England were going to be relegated with a few minutes to go and then Kane scores and we've suddenly won the group. But I think there's some great highlights. Lights there. I mean, the win in Seville was outstanding, and I think coming off the back of the World Cup, there's an awful lot of I think sort of the more cynical people might have thought this is just a flash in the pan. That's what certainly all the Welsh, Scottish, and Irish people I know were hoping. but there was, it was always seemed to have been built on a much stronger foundation because of the we know the kids coming. This is a young group anyway. There's no players current England internationals who are over 30 now because the two or three who played this year have since retired. I think Ashley Young hasn't officially retired, so. But basically this team, they're all under 30. And we know that the under 17s from last year and the group below them are extremely good. We've already seen Sancho coming through. So we always knew that we had these kids and that Southgate knew them all forensically because he's been in the system and he's overseen these age groups for a good few years in his under 21 role, which also overarched. So it always looked like it was built on solid foundations and it was going to get better after, because you could look at the World Cup, couldn't you, in two different ways. You could say England flukes it, they had a lucky draw, they got lucky against Colombia perhaps, and I think they won three and lost three, actually. The two Belgian games probably didn't matter that much, but you can look at it either one or two ways. But what's happened since has sort of accentuated the positives and we're really looking forward now with great confidence.
Mm. Yeah, to Dave's point, Sarah, 12 of the 14 players used against Croatia aged between 18 and 25. So you've got youth, you've got resilience coming back in the last 15 minutes, and you've just got a basic likability about this team. Is this the year we fell back in love with international football?
I think if you're looking at Wembley yesterday, you'd have to give that a resounding yes. You know, I've never heard anything quite like that, I don't think, at Wembley for England in recent years. And it seems crazy to think about where we were just 2 years ago at the Euros after that Iceland game, how low morale was, how low belief in this England team was, to where we are now. And what happened yesterday is like night and day. And it's no wonder that Gareth picked that up as his, you know, brightest spot from after the game yesterday. You know, he mentioned that was the biggest thing for him, the fact that the fans were now in love with this team. And we can, you know, call that sentimental, you can belittle it if you like, but I think it really does make a difference to those players and how they feel when they're on the pitch.
Because there's a real sense that we're entering the sort of second phase of Southgate's management. He took some hard decisions pre-World Cup, you know, getting rid of Rooney and people like that. And as you say, it's now, let's have a look at what he's got to work with. And if you look at it objectively, in the way, you know, the Croatia manager was saying, you know, football's coming home very soon. They should be live contenders for Euro 20. And then by definition,
the World Cup in 22.
When it's more or less a home tournament, Euro 2020, which will really help. England will play the vast majority of their, if England were to go all the way, they will play the vast majority of their games, including the semi-final and the final at Wembley, if they were to get that far. And they certainly will be major contenders. They have to be. I think that you've got players like Sancho coming in. I think the strength off the bench yesterday made a big difference. That's so often the case in a tight game at the top level. If you can bring Ali Lingard, whose England performances far outweighs Man United ones at the moment, he's been excellent for England. Dele Alli, Sancho and Lingard to come off the bench in a tight game, it makes all the difference. I think... I remember the night in Moscow, the Colombia game. That seemed to be a sea change for me. Is the way that they dealt with what was an incredibly hostile atmosphere that night. It was full of Colombians. It was a brilliant atmosphere, ear splitting, but very hostile towards England. To have sort of had the heartbreak of conceding in the 90th minute that night in a real street fight of a match, and then to come back and win it on penalties and get that one off your back. I think what happened in Moscow that night, sort of we saw it again yesterday, one down, but they still believed because they've been through that in a big, big game. And yesterday, I think we saw the benefits of that night maybe coming through again.
Mm. Let's try and sort of break it down if we can, Sarah. Maybe into sort of three distinctive age groups. That younger group who are just beginning to emerge, sort of 18 to 20 years old, I suppose the forerunner of that group was Trent Alexander-Arnold. Mm. How close is he, do you think, to becoming first choice right back for England?
I've seen some people kind of intimating that it'll be within the next year or so. I think that's a little bit harsh on Kyle Walker. But I think you could probably potentially put him, above Kieran Trippier in terms of what he gives that England side in a back four. He's more athletic. He's got the pace that Trippier maybe hasn't got. So I think... Possibly 2020, it might be a little bit too early, but 2022, you could definitely see him. He's starting games for Liverpool. He's there already in that sense, so it can't be that far away. But I think Kyle Walker, for me, just will have another couple of years as first choice.
I suppose the thing with Trent is that there is a almost like the connection of youth. Here's someone who's in tune with the community at Liverpool, still lives with his mum, works within the community. And that gets us away from the whole sort of compartmentalisation of the golden generation that we grew up with, that basically looked after themselves and they weren't broader figures.
Yeah, and that's a big thing about this England squad. I think they're all just much more relatable. Don't seem to be any, massive egos or, sort of... No golden balls, if you like, and that's been the great thing, and I think that's why people have taken to them all so readily, And I think the era that we're in now with social media helps with that because we see them more relaxed. The FA have done that very well, the way they've presented the players through social media. So that's been a big part of it, but they've all come across really well.
Mm. Yeah, they're good to deal with, aren't they, Dave?
They are. Yeah, and they certainly weren't for many years. I think it's probably unlikely that this lot happened to be all unbelievably great guys and the golden generation were all dreadful rotters. I don't think that's probably true. It's a lot to do with certainly that social media connection. Totally agree with you, Sarah. And just young people in general embrace that. They're a bit more open generally than probably people of my generation are. So there's that. But I just think they are slightly more... they've grown up in a slightly less paranoid era in terms of the FA in particular. Mm. I think they've grown up for a long while in clubs who are quite paranoid about anything getting out there. Once they've got that their own, they sort of can relate to people through social media without being restricted so much by their own clubs. I think that really helps. And people like Pickford, Maguire, Trippier in particular, I remember during all of them really, but those three stood out to me. They were just really good working class lads who you couldn't dislike. There was no side to them. There was nothing flashy about them, but they were really engaging and really likeable. And that makes a big difference. It really does. And I think also they're looking forward to playing for England. They're looking forward to international breaks. In no way is it a bind to be joining up. They like each other's company. Mm-hmm. And there's certainly been cliques and splits that you can imagine players in the golden generation era not looking forward to an international break.
Mm. With Sancho, it was only his third cap on Sunday, yet made a distinct difference to that team, you know, with the width that he got, the unpredictability of everything. Now, he's had to go away and make his impact as you know, the Bundesliga's player of the month. Mm. You've got Reiss Nelson doing something similar to three other lads. Do you think he will be seen maybe in 5 years' time as a forerunner of how actually you've got to develop your career as a young English player?
I hope so. I've been, you know, so impressed by what he's done. Obviously, Reiss Nelson's gone on loan to Hoffenheim. Jadon Sancho took the decision to actually move there permanently. And that has massively paid off. It's a risk. But then I think you can see it as a risk to stay here as well. You know, they're both calculated risks. And if it works, as it has done for Sancho and also for Reiss Nelson, then, you know, it shows what a difference it can make. And also, I think the fact that he's made this breakthrough with England now shows that players don't have to worry that if they leave the country, they'll be forgotten about. You know, Gareth Southgate will still recognise that and give them an opportunity in the England squad.
Mm. You know, two of the most prominent young players, you know, within the system still, Phil Foden at Man City and Ryan Sessegnon at Fulham. What do you make of the way they're handling their careers? You know, Foden's got the obvious difficulty of actually getting into that City team. And would Ryan Sessegnon's development have been accelerated by going somewhere else, do you think?
No, I think Sessegnon's playing week in, week out. He's had a situation at Fulham where the first choice left back's been injured and he's having to play. He's been switching between Fulham. We'll go on to Fulham later, I think. But, you know, he's not had a nailed down position this year, which hasn't helped. So he's not had the greatest start to his Premier League career, but he's still playing week in, week out. And I think as things settle down there, we'll see him improving. So definitely the right decision to stay for now, at least have one season at Fulham where he can play week in, week out in the Premier League and then maybe move on after that. Foden, of course, this kid, Foden is still only 18. He's still very young. We haven't got to be too impatient. We're almost getting used to players coming through at a very young age. But Foden and his like, if they're not getting football, they are going to... There's going to be now a natural progression to look to move abroad if they, even if he's on loan, a season long loan, it would be great, you know, a season long loan from Foden to say a Bundesliga club would be a very good next step, I think. If City aren't going to be playing him week in, week out, and it is always going to be very, very difficult for any kid of any nationality to break into that Manchester City team. It's that good, isn't it? It's possibly the best team in the world right now. So, you know, Sancho definitely, I think for me, will be a trailblazer for other English kids to go abroad. We've already seen it with Nelson. Lookman last year was very good over there as well, and we're desperate to go back to Germany. So I think Germany in particular, they've shown in the Bundesliga that they're willing to give kids a chance.
Mm. Yeah, in a way, you know, Lookman's plight is quite typical, isn't it? A bit like Hudson-Odoi at Chelsea, where they're kept as almost first-team cannon fodder, aren't they? They'll get maybe two or three games if they're lucky. Mm. That's no way to develop your career. I feel for Lookman especially.
Yeah, he's done so well when he has come on for Everton. You know, he's really made a difference when he's been used as a substitute. And I know a lot of Everton fans would like to see him start possibly this weekend. I think they've got Cardiff, haven't they? Mm. And I think the Everton fans haven't been overly impressed with Theo Walcott so far. So I think a lot of them would like to see Lookman get that opportunity. And if he doesn't start to get those starting opportunities, then I think he will get frustrated because, like you said, he's had that experience and he's obviously ready for first-team football. So it must be frustrating to go away and do that and then come back and be back in that position.
Mm. Best of the rest of that sort of age group, that 18-20 age group, you know, we're looking at maybe Aaron Wan-Bissaka at Palace, who's done exceptionally well in a short space of time. You know, someone like Rian Brewster, whose progress has been stunted by injury. Are those the sort of names that we should be keeping an eye out for?
Yeah, definitely. You mentioned Hudson-Odoi, who's lightning and a really, you know, really impressive player, wide player. I would hope, as Chelsea's got the same problem with Man City, those are the two clubs that are a real problem, I think, for English kids to be in those two. Hudson-Odoi, he was outstanding in that World Cup, under-17 World Cup victory, as was Brewster. as you say. And Wan-Bissaka, I mean, he's got a bit of a problem. I mean, there are three starting Champions League right-backs in Walker Trippier and Alexander-Arnold. I mean, that's extraordinary. And we're talking about only 27% of English players and all that. But in right-back, it's such a strong position. Wan-Bissaka looks good enough to be playing for England now, and he's fourth in the pecking order. And so he may have to be patient. But, you know, again, he's benefiting from playing regular Premier League football. Mm. There's plenty of them in the system. You know, most of those under-17s that won the World Cup could, you know, end up being full internationals. They're that good.
Yeah, yeah. Gibbs White at Wolves.
He's really good.
He does look a player. And, you know, Mason Mount at Chelsea. Over the last 2-3 years, that's been a name that's just been recurring when you've talked to scouts and say, you know, look out for this kid.
Mm. And that's obviously why Lampard, you know, made it a priority to get him in at Derby, because he knew what he was capable of. And he knew, you know, if he gave him those opportunities to play week in, week out in the Championship, what he could bring to that team. Again, it's difficult at Chelsea, you know, looking back, there hasn't been many opportunities for young English players. So where Mason Mount goes when he returns to Chelsea will be interesting. You have to hope that there will be opportunities there. Perhaps at the end of the season, there might be, you know, we'll see what happens with Fabregas. A few players like that could be on their way out, and we'll see what happens.
Mm. The fact that Barkley actually, I know he's a bit older, he's 23, 24, but the fact that I was concerned that Barkley, I thought, because Barkley looked like he was going to go to Spurs, I thought that's going to be a better move for he'll play. At Chelsea, thought he could go missing. But the fact that Barkley's played week in, week out, even a little bit older, sort of gives you a little bit more hope maybe for some of the younger players, the Mounts and Hudson-Odoi, that they may get some game time to break through.
Let's look at the sort of second group, which is sort of 21, 22, that sort of age group. I suppose the poster boy for that group probably is Rashford. Is his development slowing because of what's going on at Man United? What do you make of it?
A little bit, yeah. He's played a fair bit of football, hasn't he? And I think he prefers to play as a nine, but he always looks better as a wide, you know, player cutting inside for me. Rashford, I don't think he's... the amount of games he's playing is decent, either starting or off the bench. He's getting a decent amount of football. It's just an air of gloom at that football club. Even when they've been getting results, there's been very little freedom about the way they play. And he looks like, and particularly that night in Seville, he looks like he's really enjoying being with England. And that's a bit of an outlet for him at the moment. Rashford's doing all right. I don't think he would... I think he'll probably benefit if management did change at United, as it probably will do at some point in the next year anyway.
Mm. The person who's probably most impressed me in that group was Joe Gomez at Liverpool. You know, overcame untimely injuries. The goal at Wembley yesterday was a result of his long throw, so kudos to Liverpool's Danish long throw coach. When you're looking at someone like Gomez, does he sort of sum up the fact that a young player needs a manager who believes?
Yeah, I think so. I don't think you can underestimate the importance of that belief for young players and their ability to go out on the pitch and not fear, you know, making mistakes, they're almost, you know... Going back to 2016 again, we saw the players look fearful of making mistakes. With young players in particular, you want them to be fearless. You know, we saw with Rashford making some of those runs in the second half yesterday. He just went for it, and that's brilliant to see. And the same with Gomez, you know, he's looked confident. And again, if they do, you know, if there is an error, their head doesn't go down. That's where the ability to come back and the resilience comes into play. You know, if they don't fear making mistakes, then they can play with much more freedom.
Mm. Not often we look to Leicester to lead, you know, with the greatest respect to Leicester. But if you look at the young core of players there that has just been started to be developed, you've got Madison, you've got Chilwell and Maguire, who you spoke about. How important is it to have those club cells, as it were?
Yeah, it can be, yeah. And Gray, I think, is certainly got the talent to play for England regularly as well. I mean, I think Leicester, the way they developed their squad since the title win, they've been quite big on bringing in English talent. Madison looks a real player, doesn't he? And you're not entirely sure where he's going to fit in. So they've got so many options in those sort of, you know, sort of 7, 10, 11 positions. Madison would normally play as a 10. I'm not sure. He'd be quite a way down the pecking order, really. But, yeah, Leicester is a club that Southgate, I think, is enjoying going to. Maguire, obviously, I agree about Gomez being outstanding, and Maguire looked like he was nailed on, particularly because, obviously, Southgate was playing three centre-halves at the World Cup, and that looked, we assumed he would stick with that, having had success. Again, it's almost like been a third part. You said this is part two of Southgate. It's almost part three, because he went from the fairly dull qualification to the back three, which took us through the World Cup. Then he's reshaped it again. I think Gomez and Stones now looks like the sort of two for England, and Maguire's actually out in the cold, strangely, you know, having been the great sort of cult hero of the World Cup.
How, you know, your work on the website, Sarah, you have coaches, you know, talking about their craft. In doing those interviews, have you picked up any strain of influence, for instance, that, you know, someone like Gareth Southgate is now having? You know, maybe it's just confidence in the younger breed of British coach.
As in the influence that Southgate's having on young coaches?
Yeah.
That's a good question. It might be too early for that. I think, you know, the younger coaches that are coming through, they are now getting some opportunities. Some of them have gone abroad to get those opportunities. So I think they're seeing that there are, you know, if you keep working, you might get those openings. I remember when Southgate got the job, and actually when we spoke to him for the site in January, so the beginning of this year, the reaction that we got to some of the first pieces that we put out was not, you know, was not complimentary. People weren't convinced at all by him. People were saying, you know, how he's so dull. How can he inspire these players? And it's amazing how it's flipped. So I think his influence, there will be an influence over the next 12 months or so. I think a lot of the young coaches, the young aspiring coaches, are looking to him and saying, well, you know, look at what this guy's doing. You don't have to be over 50 to have a big job. But yeah, I think it will take a bit of time.
Mm. Let's look at that older age group. You know, by old, they're 23 to 25, that sort of age. I suppose Harry Kane stands out from it. You know, 8 goals in out of the 28 that England have scored this year. When's his battery going to run out?
I don't know. Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, you really thought it might after the World Cup. He's been playing, it seems like, constant football for years and years. He's got such an appetite for it, though. He's a big kid. I don't think he's ever going to grow up in terms of his desire to play football constantly. Stones would be a similar age group as well. Stones is utterly key to England now, isn't he, I think? Mm. You know, he looks like he's nailed on to play in central defence for as long as he wants to. Kane... he sort of seemed to have he scored in August because he was playing Fulham. That was lucky for him. but he did have a little bit of a dip. But it was good to see him score that big goal for England. He hadn't scored for England since the Colombian match, and actually sort of tailed off towards the end of the World Cup. So it's been a little bit. People in the Spurs dressing room have noticed he's been not quite 100%. But even a Kane who's a little bit worn out is still a very, very good world class goal scorer.
I think the thing with Kane is when you look at him after matches, he doesn't seem he's quite cool emotionally. I think that if you're not, you know, if you're not getting too het up emotionally, obviously he's passionate. You're not getting that emotional fatigue that comes along with the physical fatigue that, you know, you would suffer after World Cup. So I think that helps him in a way. He's able to kind of keep his cool, and that allows him to recover.
Don't make the highs too high and don't make the lows too low.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Alongside him, a Tottenham teammate, Dele Alli. You know, he's one of these deceptive characters in a way. You know, people almost perceive there's a bit of arrogance there, but actually when you talk to the guy, he's a very, very good, grounded lad. Bit of a in and out season so far because of various reasons. What do you expect him to be for, say, the second half of the season?
Yeah, like you said, there's been a bit of consistency missing from his game this season, and it might concern him that he didn't start the game yesterday, because he has been, you know, quite a sort of stalwart starter in Southgate's team. So I think there's a big opportunity for him the second half of the season. Spurs are still fighting on lots of fronts, so there's a real opportunity for him to to say I'm one of the main men in this Spurs team, alongside Harry, obviously. Mm. But yeah, we'll need to see a bit more consistency in terms of level of performance, I think, from Dele.
Mm. You know, we're painting a lovely rosy picture here, Dave, so let's just be a bit downbeat for a change. You know, go back to revert to type, some people might say. What are the weaknesses of this squad? What about
central midfield?
Yeah,
is the glaring weakness, and probably goalkeeper if Pickford was injured. There's no one else to come in really. I mean, there's the Burnley guys, but that's a bit strange in terms of Hart going there. They're not playing at the moment. Goalkeeping's not a lot of depth in the goalkeeping position if Pickford were injured. But certainly central midfield is the problem. We haven't got that Modric or Rakitic, have we? And it was probably a handy that Rakitic wasn't there. So. Possibly Winks. I'm not seeing enough from Winks. He looks decent, but again, not absolutely world class. Maybe if Winks played week in, week out, we may see him develop into that sort of player. I think Foden would normally play a little bit more advanced. He might be more of a 10. He might play as an 8, though, Foden, maybe. I've just never been convinced by either Dier or Henderson at the top level. Delph is a player that Southgate absolutely loves as a personality. He's an infectious type, but he would admit himself he's not a world-class footballer. He's a very good one to have around the squad. So that is that central midfield is the glaring problem in terms of a team that is, as we are now, a top five, top six team, to a team that are going to win a major tournament. That is the one thing, that's the one area you could see where we may miss out.
Mm. And if we're looking at the veterans, Callum Wilson, ancient at 26, does he deserve a good look?
Yeah, I think so. I thought he did well against the USA when he played. And you look at what he's come through in terms of the injuries to get back to this point, and that says a lot for a person's character, mentality, dedication to what, you know, to his sport. So I mean, obviously it's difficult. We're quite, you know, blessed in terms of striking options and forward line, but yeah, I think definitely, and you look at what he's doing for Bournemouth this season, you know, he's playing really well, and so I think Gareth wants to give him that opportunity, and hopefully we'll get a few more.
Mm. Let's sort of change tack a bit and look at the return of the Premier League, Dave. You know, your affiliation with Fulham is pretty well known. The key game of the weekend, Fulham Southampton. You've got a new coach in Claudio Ranieri. What's your take on him?
On Ranieri, I don't think it's going to be as much fun at Fulham to watch them now. I think that he's a very strange person in many ways, Ranieri, because the public image is dilly-ding, dilly-dong, slightly cartoonish, sort of. It's incredibly warm and very friendly
guy. Burgers for all and all that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Pizzas and stuff. But behind the scenes, he's an Italian football coach he's 67 years old, I think, you know, and he's done it for 30-odd years. You know, he comes from, you know, he started off in the 1980s in Italy. He's a hard man. He likes a team to defend well. You know, it wasn't, you know, the fact that Leicester won the Premier League was a miracle. They won it with 40% possession over the course of a season on average. They won game after game with 30% of the possession. It was an extraordinary achievement, built on a very solid defence. And he won it with Wes Morgan and Robert Huth in central defence in their 30s. That you know, they're not well-beaten players. He and his coaching staff have got very good ideas of how to organise a defence and play well without the ball. And that's the difference going to be going forward for Fulham.
Mm. Were you surprised that Slav Jovanovic was let go?
Not surprised, but saddened, because he had an outstanding last couple of seasons there. I don't think Fulham fans have enjoyed their football as much as that for many, many years. And there were certain reasons why it's been so shambolic this season that weren't entirely his fault. There were a lot of injuries in defence. The one thing that you need to correct that everyone says is Fulham made too many signings in the summer. They had six players on loan last year. They lost another one on a free transfer at the end of the season. So they needed to buy in seven players just to get back to where they were. And then you've got to have some sort of improvement. Mm-hmm. So that they had to spend pretty big. The £100 million thing that gets bandied around, yep, they've overspent on a couple of players. That wasn't Jokanovic's fault. Those couple of players weren't his players that he didn't want particularly anyway. A guy called Anguissa from France, it was the record signing, nearly £30 million. Wasn't a player that he made it pretty obvious that he didn't want him. So there were a lot of reasons why Jokanović should feel hard done by. But at the end of the day, 5 points, 100 million, it's almost going to happen, isn't it?
And you know, we were talking earlier on, Sarah, it's a surprise that only one manager's gone, you know, by this stage of the season. Is it likely to be two if Southampton lose at the Cottage?
Yeah, there's obviously, there's quite a lot of potential for that, given what's been going on at Southampton with Les Reed leaving, who was the man that brought Mark Hughes in. You know, you would have to think that he's got an inkling in the back of his head that his days are possibly shortening by the week. And yeah, you know, it's a massive game for Southampton. With a new manager in at Fulham, he'll be wary of that new manager bounce. It's a shame Jokanović didn't get the opportunity to take Fulham into this game. So yeah, potentially we could see two gone. But again, that's quite few for the Premier League before, with Christmas, you know, a month away.
All the coaches you deal with, how do they deal with the reality is that, you know, 18 months they're going to get the sack?
Most of them are quite phlegmatic about it. I think one of the quotes that sticks with me is from Paul Simpson, who's actually coach of the England under-20s that won the World Cup. But he's had quite a long career in club management. And he said, it was Jim Smith told him, you know, you're not a proper manager until you've been sacked. And I think we've all probably heard that quote from managers. You know, they know what the reality is. It doesn't mean it affects them any less, but I think it means they can get over it quicker. And most of them say the worst part is the few days afterwards when your phone suddenly goes quiet. And you know, you suddenly feel like, well, there's nothing going on, and that you plunged into this black hole. I'm sure you've heard similar stories.
The phone goes mad for 2 days, 3 days, and it just sort of tails off.
Everything stops. Yeah. And that's the moment when they think, oh, you know, am I going to get back in? And that's the panic and the fear. And then that can lead to taking the wrong jobs and all sorts. So, it's a difficult period.
Because it is interesting with Mark Hughes. He's got this sort of perception that he's one of these magic roundabout managers. He trips here and there. You know, he was at Fulham, of course.
Yeah, 1 year there. Only 1 year. And then suddenly went to go somewhere, showed more ambition, and went to QPR and made a complete car crash of that. So there won't be any Fulham supporters who'd be sad to see Fulham beat them and put his job in peril. Unfortunately, it's a harsh old game. He won the season at Fulham. He did quite well, actually. Straight on from the Hodgson era, and he had quite a lot of continuity. He is one of those guys who all suddenly got jobs middle of last season, and there was a stat going around that I remember trying to add up. I think between five or six of them, they'd had about 30 jobs, and none of them had ever won a trophy, you know, a major trophy in English football. So,
and all double the age, at least double the age of the average England player, I would think.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, there is a real generational thing, and it's become more of an old man's game in management in the Premier League. It's become more of an old man's game in recent years.
One of the great sort of refreshing figures this season, I think, has been Sarri at Chelsea. You know, it's almost a third place playoff on Saturday, isn't it? You know, the BT Sport game at Tottenham. Do you think we've underestimated Chelsea's achievement this season? You know, 12 matches unbeaten.
Yeah, it has gone under the radar, hasn't it? Because of how good City have been, how excited people are about Liverpool. But, you know, he's come into that team. He's new to the Premier League. He's changed the system. He's changed the style. You know, I don't think people were quite expecting them to do this well so quickly. You know, it normally takes a little bit of time to adapt to the Premier League. It has gone under the radar. And I think if they get a win over Spurs at the weekend and that unbeaten run continues, then maybe people will start talking about them a bit more.
Spurs used 24 players this season, which probably tells you all you need to know about Pochettino as a manager. Makes do and mend.
Yeah, also the fact that I think that he's having to manage fatigue with about 14 of those players probably having been involved in the tail end of the World Cup, semi-finals, finals, third place playoffs, etc. It was a real problem that for Spurs more than any other club, wasn't it? But he's done a fantastic job. They've struggled in the Champions League this year, but their league form's still very, very good. It's going to be, you know, you assume United are out of the picture, but I think Arsenal have been good. So, you know, there is, it's going to be those three London clubs, I think, challenging for third, fourth and fifth place probably. But, you know, one of them is going to miss out on Champions League football next year.
Who do you think will miss out?
Probably Arsenal, but I think I've been really impressed with what Emery's done there. I think he's really improved things without spending very much money. As we've said, Chelsea, Sarri, I thought he had a hell of a job on his hands, Sarri, and I think he's done really well. I mentioned it before, I love the way he's embraced Barkley, and Barkley's really come on leaps and bounds under him. I think they're enjoying their football, aren't they? And they weren't enjoying it under Conte the last season in particular. Hazard's been reborn. So, yeah, I think Arsenal will probably miss out, but not by much.
Mm. What do you think, if we look at United, Sarah, a lot of talk about Jose Mourinho trying to influence the appointment of a technical director. Now, surely that defeats the object, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, if he ends up bringing in someone who is basically his own man, then it's not going to have quite the impact and effect on the team that it possibly should have to have a technical director in there, someone who, you know, brings in their own ideas, who Jose has to be answerable to, who has his own input into recruitment, etc. So yes, I mean, it'll be interesting to see who does end up coming in and how, you know, how well they know Jose, how the networking kind of figures out between them. But yeah, like you said, it would be a shame almost if he just ends up bringing in someone who's his own man.
Yeah. What about the principle of that job? Do you think it's a good one?
I do, yeah. You speak to any manager who's worked in Europe and they all, that's how it works, you know, and they all think it works. They like the fact, the managers like the fact all the that they can be a head coach, focus on what's going on the pitch. And also, if you've got two of you almost to kind of share the load, and also when things aren't going so well, it's not just the manager, it's not just you in the spotlight. It almost, you know, it helps take the pressure off a little bit, I think, to have that. So yeah, I think managers who come from Europe are quite surprised when they're thrust into an English club and everything is, you know, on their table. Their to-do list is pile high.
Mm-hmm. You know, Jose for Christmas, his Christmas present, he wants a centre-half, that's pretty obvious. He was spotted watching Belgium. Alderweireld?
Yeah, and we certainly wanted him in the summer. They wouldn't push the boat out for big money. You deal with Spurs, you have to pay over the odds. And Alderweireld looked like it was going to happen, and it didn't because, you know, United were unsure about Mourinho. They still are unsure about Mourinho. They're not sure whether to back his hunches. I think Alderweireld's such a established Premier League player that you know, it wouldn't be any great punt to go for Alderweireld, even if you're going to sack your manager a few months down the line. But yeah, they've got to bring another central defender in. But I do get the impression Jose's been sort of sulking about it too much, talking to the decent players he's already got. Baye's the one who always looked to me as though he was the best of the bunch they've got there. He's been frozen out. There's obviously been a schism there between him and Mourinho. You do get the impression that sometimes he can cut off his own nose to spite his face. He's not happy and he wants the world to know he's not happy, and he's quite happy to belittle his own players to get that point across.
Mm. It's an interesting one on Saturday, Sarah. Crystal Palace are at Old Trafford. If he's fit, Wilf Sahar will be going back to the club that he was there for about 10 seconds flat. Mm. Is he a bit of a warning sign to some young players about making that big move? You know, I remember him saying that, you know, when I went up there, I ended up on my own, living in digs in Stockport, really had no support network around me. Yet now he's back in familiar circumstances at Palace, shoulders are back, and he's the man, isn't he? Mm.
Yeah, it's interesting. I hope they don't see it as a reason to be put off, being ambitious and wanting to make that big move. Because I think if you look at the player that Zaha is now, how much of that is due to the experiences that he had at Manchester United? You know, they would have made him more stronger mentally, more resilient. I don't want players to be put off having that ambition, but then, yes, you know, some decisions you make won't be the right ones. Some clubs won't be the right fit. And I think that was an example of that. But I think, you know, some people use it as a stick to beat him with and say, well, he couldn't do it. A big club. I think you put him in a big bigger club than Palace now, and I think he'd be absolutely fine.
Because it's confidence in the end, isn't it?
Exactly, yeah. And if you have the right manager that, you know, has a belief in him, and he feels that, you know, he has the freedom to do what he does at Palace for the team, then, yeah, I think any team would love to have him.
You got Manchester City at West Ham, the Pellegrini derby.
Yeah, sure. I mean, City have tended to go there and win handsomely, haven't they? And I would imagine the same again. If they were on a different level to anyone else. I've never been convinced by Pellegrini. A lot of people at Man City would tell you they were never convinced by Pellegrini that he won a title there. It's almost as if he won it by default. It's a bit harsh on him, but I think he was very much a sort of passive kind of individual who actually at an elite club, you almost can be like that. You can just get by. Man City has got such a great group of talented players that, to some extent, you can get away with being relatively passive in the modern era. Ancelotti, I think, is in the same bracket and has had great success. He's maybe got slightly more about him than Pellegrini, but I wasn't convinced that he was the right man for West Ham. I think there was quite a lot of excitement amongst West Ham fans because he's got a good CV. He's won the title, and, you know, he's at West Ham. That's great, but I'm not sure if he's somebody who can grab hold of a club of West Ham's, you know, a sort of mid to lower Premier League club and make them into the sort of top six contenders that West Ham believe they should be.
You've got to have a bit more about you.
Bit more about you there.
than making a 6-month lunge for Sami Nasri, for instance.
Yeah, I know. Nasri's that's the bad old West Ham, isn't it? That's a bad old West Ham signing for me. It's not so much Pellegrini as much as Golden Sullivan's sort of thing they've done too much of during their tenure, I think. No, I think Nasri's not a great character to have in the dressing room either.
Yeah, well, if that's a sort of DVD type signing, you know, I suppose the best example of measured, you know, but well-resourced recruitment has been Liverpool. You know, there's some talk that, you know, they might even ship out Fabinho, bring in Pulisic from Dortmund. You know, they're at Watford. Is this a sort of a litmus test type of game? Because they were awful there last season, weren't they?
Yeah, potentially. And they've got quite a difficult run coming up, I think, over Christmas. So we're entering into a really interesting period for Liverpool that will test their, you know, fine start to the season in terms of results anyway. I know performances haven't been quite perhaps what we were expecting compared to last year. So, yeah, it will be interesting. And Watford, you never really know what you're going to get. They've had some great results this season. They've had some that recently, I think, did they lose to Newcastle? Some surprising results, if you like. But they've got players that can, you know, do some damage. But yeah, I think Klopp will see this as a good opportunity to go into this Christmas period with on a bit of a high.
Shaqiri's done well, hasn't he? And it's almost as if that club now matches his ego.
Absolutely, yeah. He always felt at Stoke. He felt he was a bit too big for all that. I like Shaqiri. He's a good signing for them with very little money. And having said that, they just haven't. It's very strange, isn't it? You know, the whole thing about, you know, champions often win titles by not playing well and winning. But I think there's been a little bit too much not playing well for Liverpool. It's been a bit of a trend. It's not just been a few odd games. They've just not been what they were last season. It's which way are they going to go now? Are they going to get back to last season, or are they going to start, the results are now going to start reflecting how relatively poorly they've been playing this season? It'll be interesting. And Watford is, like you say, it is a litmus test game. It's a tough away game. They can be, you know, that place can get rocking. And they've got a good squad now. They've got a pretty settled team at Watford, and they can do some damage. If they get you early and get ahead, then that's a very tough place to be.
Just a few questions from the listeners and the viewers. Start, Sarah, with you, if I could, please. Chris Etchingham, what will be the impact of Brexit on English clubs keeping and attracting European players? I suppose what he's getting at is, you know, you've already got that clash between the Premier League, who are saying, look, there should be no eligibility problems, let them all in. And you've got the FA saying, well, let's have quotas. Where are we going to go with that?
Yeah, that's a nice, easy question, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think, as with everything with Brexit, no one really knows what the impact is going to be. The FA have talked about changing the number of English players that you've got to have in your squad, you know, in exchange for letting players come in from Europe.
Is that a good thing?
I think it probably is a good thing. I don't feel quite so comfortable with them sort of using Brexit as a means to do it. But perhaps that's the only way it will ever happen. The thing for me is, you know, we were talking about Jadon Sancho earlier going, you know, and him being a forerunner for English players looking to move abroad. That, you know, the impact of Brexit could make that much more difficult. And, you know, if clubs have to have more English players in their squad, they won't necessarily be using them all. You know, you look at Gary Cahill at Chelsea, a lot of people say that perhaps Chelsea are keeping there just to up their numbers of homegrown players, but he's not actually getting to play. And that's what we don't want, is English players being stuck at a club to increase the number of homegrown players, but not being able to move on. So, yeah, both in terms of players coming in, which could become more difficult, as well as young English players getting their opportunity elsewhere.
Mm. Stuart Horsfield, is it realistically possible for a player to win the Ballon d'Or while playing in the Premier League?
Yeah, absolutely. It is. Yeah. I don't see why not. I mean, that always been obviously been completely dominated by two men for over a decade now. Mm. So, I think a Manchester City player, for instance, I think Man City will win the Champions League this year. I think there's a very good chance they will. And I don't see why there couldn't be a Man City player emerged to win that award next year. Modric is likely to win it. I don't see any reason why a Premier League player couldn't win it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, this is the final question. One from Jim Benage. There were reports of thousands outside Wembley queuing to get in when they kicked off yesterday. What have fans done to deserve Wembley?
For me?
Yeah, if you like.
If Wembley didn't have the name Wembley, and that's more for people who've never been to Wembley and never tried to travel there by train or by car, then they would never have rebuilt the National Stadium at Wembley. It's just the name and the prestige of the place, which is genuinely has a global, same as the Maracanã. Maracanã and Wembley will probably be the two biggest stadium names in the world. So there's, because that decision was made entirely because of the name Wembley. It particularly when Burton's been built, why wouldn't the National Stadium be somewhere slap bang in the middle of the country near Burton, near St George's Park, I'm talking about. It doesn't make any sense. So, yeah, I've got a great... even journalists, we've got the same problems in terms of getting there. I mean, it's 50 quid to park at some games. The category...
That's that, right.
Tottenham v Real Madrid's 50 quid to park there. And I think it's between 30 and 50 in sort of Wembley car parks. And they've built hotels on some of the car parking space there as well, making it even worse. And as we know, you know, the Metropolitan line quite often malfunctions.
Because Spurs fans are voting with their feet as well, aren't they? And it looks like they're going to have to put up Wembley until March now.
Yeah. I've heard from some Spurs fans that talking about having to... They've already bought their season ticket for the new stadium, but with each game that they're not at the new stadium, they're having to almost ask for a refund for that ticket and buy a new ticket. Mm. So it's crazy. And obviously Spurs fans are, like you said, they're voting with their feet and deciding, you know, we've done it last season. It was a novelty last season. This season, that's enough. Mm. March, yeah.
Long time.
It's a way away.
Just to end with a story which I think will probably dominate certainly the early part of the week, the continuing power struggle at the PFA. You've got, on the one hand, Gordon Taylor, to some, you know, representative of almost like an unelected elite, but he's been there 37 years. On the other side, you've got Ben Perkis, 34-year-old fullback from Walsall, non-contract player now because of injury. But a revolt which is actually gathering real momentum. More than 200 players are already saying that Gordon Taylor must go. How do you see it playing out?
Yeah, it does feel like the end game for Taylor. I mean, he's been there. I mean, I remember starting out on Fleet Street over 20 years ago, and he wasn't a young man then, and he's still there. And you know, this sort of has come up, you know, hang on, aren't you supposed to, as a trade union leader, stand for election? You know, are there, you know, are they not supposed to be, is every 5 years, by all accounts? And it's as if no one's ever really thought about it before. This book just goes on and on and on. There's some very questionable, there's some real questions to ask. In if Taylor were to actually put himself forward for election, there would be some really interesting questions to ask about the finances of that organisation, including his own salary, which is extraordinary, £2.5 million a year.
Yeah, it was 2.29, I think it was. But and in that sense, and I think the year before was over 3, highest paid union official in the world. You've got an operation which has £50 million in the bank and only give research for something like concussion £100,000. Something's wrong somewhere, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's amazing, really, that it's taken Ben Perkis to come in and ask the question and just say, can we look into how things are run here, for people to suddenly say, oh, hang on a minute, this is wrong. This guy's been in charge for over 30 years. Without having to answer these difficult questions. Like David said, I think it probably is the end game for Gordon, looking at the numbers and the amount of questions that are building up around his job. I can't really see how he comes out of it.
Well, the PFA needs to modernise and the players have spoken. Time to go, Gordon. Thanks for joining us here on the Football Writers Podcast.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like worried of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.